the buzzer, McCord on its way. Oh, my goodness.
They have to get it. No timeouts. They do.
Courtside with Greenberg and Dockage, the definitive college basketball podcast.
Hey, welcome 2020. We are here. I am Dan Dockage, the Coach Whisperer, three-time ACC Coach of the Year, the great Seth Greenberg, and I will take you through everything you need to know in the world's greatest podcast in college basketball. Are you kidding me? Seth Greenberg, happy holidays, and welcome to 2020, my friend.
How about that? 2020. I was trying to think, where was I 20 years ago? Where was I 10 years ago? What was I doing? I mean, like, it's amazing how quickly time goes by. It does not stand still, but you know what? In 2020, it's going to be an incredible year. The doom and gloom of college basketball is far, absolutely blows my mind, because college basketball is in a good place. We are going to have great games in 2020. We're going to have a great NCAA tournament. We're going to have a great rest of the season. I am fired up about 2020. What about you, D-Squared?
Oh, I say it all the time. Every night, college basketball delivers. I'm fired up. I got some resolutions. I went from vegan to now I'm no carbs. It changes every day, my friend. So,
Whoa. Time out. I mean, you were all in. You were on the road. You were all in on the vegan. I think you were with your guy Benetti or Shambi or one of your guys. Now, you went from vegan to no carbs. There's no chance. I just want to make let's get this right at you. There's no chance that lasts a week.
I can't make that. I'm on diet 9,672 since 1990. So I got no I'm happy to made it yesterday, truthfully, because yesterday was a tough one. I had to look up wine yesterday, make sure I was doing all right. So, no, man. Speaking of yesterday, I know it was a college football day, but it was a low-key, pretty good day January 1st in college basketball. Seth, so let me ask you, Creighton. Creighton real?
I think they are real. I think the Big East is really real. Like, there's no rocket chair games in the Big East. It's a joke. Every single game, Providence comes up, and they play at an absolutely high level this past weekend. But Creighton's for real for a couple of reasons. Number one, they terrific guard play. Number two, they make shots. They don't turn it over. Their guards come back and rebound. They play with great spacing. They got an incredible home court, and they've got toughness. I think they are for real. They're an upper-class team. Zagrowski, Balak, Tayshaun Alexander. I just think that they are no joke. I think they are really good. They're hard to defend. Better at home, obviously. But that league in general, man, you better play well in that league, or you're not winning. You're just not winning.
And then speaking of that league, Butler two nights ago, New Year's Eve, I guess it was, went into Jamaica, New York, got up 21 on St. John's and got to win. I'm going to ask you about another team. Now, I know it cost them two national titles in 2002 when I left West Virginia after, I don't even know how many days it was of their ridiculousness. But they've hired two pretty good coaches since, right? They've hired two pretty good coaches. Beilein, pretty good, obviously, and Huggins, pretty good, two Hall of Famers. But you know what? Of the three, I'm the only one walking around with a national championship ring. So, again, I'm sorry, West Virginia fans who continue to crush me on Twitter. I know you're pining. I know it's been 18 years, but I ain't coming back. So just deal with what you have. But speaking of West Virginia, Seth Greenberg, Bob Huggins and the boys beat the hell out of Ohio State.
Yeah, and you know, I think you hit it right on the head, Dan. They beat the hell out of Ohio State. And what we mean by that was they were a tougher, more physical team. And I always said a hardest playing, toughest team finds a way to win. If you can, you want to upset someone, impose your will and your system. Now, I was shocked. Here's what I was shocked about. I was shocked that an Ohio State team that I think has great poise, terrific guard play, a tough matchup, obviously, Caleb Wesson. I was shocked that Bob Huggins was able to keep the ball on one side of the court, an eyeball reversal, pressure, forced 21 or 22 turnovers. They didn't dominate them on the glass, which I actually thought they would dominate them on. But I thought defensively they were dominating in terms of pressuring Ohio State, getting them out of rhythm, pushing them a step further out, and basically taking them out of anything they wanted to do. That was a shock to me. But the size, the physicality, the toughness, and Miles McBride, I remember talking to Huggs because I am the Coach Whisperer in September. And he said, I think I got something special in Miles McBride. Miles McBride was the best guard on the court that day.
He was by far. And I thought he took DJ Carton and the rest of Ohio State's perimeter guys completely out of their game. I did. I thought that Ohio, and I used that word that, you know, I used the word beat, or I don't know whatever word I used, on purpose, because I thought it was a very physical game, and I thought it was a very tough game, and I thought that that is the style of play that West Virginia seemed very comfortable doing, Seth Greenberg. I do. I think they seemed very comfortable just knocking the living hell out of folks.
Yeah, and they're doing it in the half court more than the full court. You know, the whole press Virginia thing was a thing.
Yeah.
But now, they're not extending as far out, but once you cross half court, their ability to pressure the ball, their ability to keep it on one side, and physical. I mean, look, Tshiebwe is a large human being as a freshman, and he is physical. And he got in foul trouble. He already even had an impact in the game. But when you got a guy like, you know, Derek Culver, who's a prep school kid, when you got Emmett Matthews, when you got big, physical, tough players. I touched base with Huggs the other day, and I said that this team looks like one of his teams. This team looks like one of his old Cincinnati teams, actually. The physicality, the toughness, the kind of pushing the ball down to a small box. You know, this is what you expect when you play Bob Huggins, and I think they've got their DNA or their personality back. Last year, their guard play was so bad that, you know, it was almost impossible to watch him. This team is very different. The Big 12, Baylor themselves, Kansas. I'm not sure who that fourth team would be. No one's really emerged consistently. I think the likely kid, if he comes back for Oklahoma State, maybe Oklahoma State will be a team that you talk about. But it'll be interesting in the Big 12, especially early on, because West Virginia, I think, goes to Kansas to start off.
Yeah, I'm, West Virginia folks, I'm sorry. I know it cost you two titles, and I know you're still upset about it, I could tell on Twitter, but you got a really good coach in there, and hopefully, as you said, they play the way that Bob Huggins' team have always played. All right, let's go to the top. Is there anybody from this point on, Seth Greenberg, is there anybody that's going to challenge Gonzaga? They're number one, right? I mean, Duke's number two, Kansas number three. All right. Duke's going to have some roads, you know, some bumps. Kansas, from now until the tournament, is this just going to be we got Gonzaga at number one and who's number two because they're not going to lose?
Well, they got two tough road games at BYU and at St. Mary's. BYU is a tough place to play. You're dealing with the altitude.
Horrible.
You're dealing with the physicality. And they get Yuli Childs back, who is a double-double waiting to happen and can shoot a three. You know, Hawes is tough. Toulson is a big-time three-point shooter. Both St. Mary's and BYU shoot a ton of threes. So you live by the three, you die by the three. St. Mary's, I'm not sure they're good enough defensively. They are good enough offensively. Jordan Ford can control the tempo of the game. The thing that impressed me with Gonzaga, Joel Yai. I looked at Gonzaga, and like I say, at times they get disinterested defensively. But like, I rewatched the Oregon game this weekend. Why? I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. But as I'm watching the game, they're up 16 points, and then all of a sudden they kind of got loose offensively, took some quick shots, turned it over. On the other end, they just seemed disinterested defensively for a period of time. Can they get disinterested on the road? I mean, they're the Duke of the West Coast Conference in that they're the biggest game on everyone's schedule. So therefore, it's the white out, it's blue out, it's orange out, it's green out. Now, those teams aren't good enough because they don't have the quality of the depth in their leagues. But BYU and St. Mary's are legit. They're legit, and they have shot makers, and they have a system. And the one thing, St. Mary's has had success against them. So those are the two games. They get through those two games, they're going to run the table. Here's the bigger thing. Do you think that because they're not challenged, that's a disadvantage because they never get their temperature raised to the point where they're in those games that they can time and score and possession and side out of bounds, underneath out of bounds, a late game, that they're not tested like you're going to get tested in the tournament?
I don't think it's bad. And I'll tell you why, Seth. I could be dead wrong. I think sometimes getting tested over and over and over breaks some teams. You know what I mean? I mean, these guys, by the time we get to the tournament, are so used to winning. It's like losing isn't even in the equation, and that's an advantage, in my opinion. I don't really know, Seth. I think every team is different. I think every team is organic. It grows in different ways, and I do think that Gonzaga, this year's team, will be used to winning I know this. In 2 years ago, so what would that be? Gosh, I'm about 17, I think. Whenever it was, they were going to lose to Greensboro in the first round of the tournament. They were going to lose. And they ended up going at least to the Sweet 16. I don't know where I can't remember where they ended up. They beat Ohio State in the next game. But the truth of the matter is, I think each team is different, and I think this Gonzaga team is good enough to beat anybody. Let me go this route. How good's Duke? You know, they got a guy averaging 18-9 that no one's talking about in Vernon Carey Jr. That ain't bad. And when you're doing it as a freshman at Duke, holy cow, why aren't we talking more about Vernon Carey?
Yeah, no, I think Vernon Carey's true. One thing about Gonzaga that people should know is Mark Few makes every single practice, every single drill, once they get into league play, competitive, where there's a winner and a loser. And he also, they go like on like scrimmage. So they basically don't go first team, second team, so that they remain competitive. Duke, here's the thing with Duke. You got an elite point guard, Trey Jones, who can disrupt the game. You got a low post scorer. Now, Matthew Hurt, in the last five games, is averaging about 15 points a game. His scoring's up, his shooting's up. Gives him a stretch four. Think about Coach K, his best teams have had stretch four. I mean, basically, that's what they've done. They've taken the three guy, put him at the four. The wing guys can guard. Cassius Stanley can get out and pass lanes. I still said my man Joey Baker or Alex O'Connell, one of those guys has got to have an impact on the game because they need a shot maker if you're going to play through Vernon Carey. But Vernon Carey is an absolute load. And everyone lost their mind. They came back after the holidays. Trey Jones didn't play. And they're playing and they're just kind of going through the motions. Look, we all know the game after Christmas, the game before Christmas, the game before Thanksgiving, brutal games for teams. So you just want to get through those games and get back into practice, kind of drive your guys the point home that you need to get driven home because you're getting into league play. But Duke, especially this year, and I have the DNA of a championship team or a Final Four team. You've got to have experience. No more than one freshman. Last 4 years, no more than one freshman has had an impact on a Final Four team. You got to have experienced guards. You got to have good guards. You got to be a top 25 in offensive, defensive efficiency. You can't turn it over and spit it up all over the place. And you got to have a pro. Excluding the experience, although Duke does have the experience, they fit every one of those measurables.
When you look overall, all right, let's keep it there. Does Kansas fit those measurables?
I think they do. I mean, people say they don't shoot a great all the time. Here's my big concern about Kansas. At time they get loose with the ball. I mean, even the other day, they turned it over like 21 times the other day. I mean, at times they dominated Stanford, yet they turned the ball over. I think Obagi's an improved shooter. I think Dotson's an elite point guard. I think that Udoka has a book. He's not Vernon Carey. He's not even close to being as good as Vernon Carey. Let's put that. The biggest thing for Kansas, I think, and they're an elite defensive team. The biggest thing, I think, is they got to take care of the basketball, and they got to learn to play out of a double team. Their post action, when Udoka has a book, he gets doubled. And no one's going to play on the high side and let him throw over the top, I don't think. I think you try to get him off the block, and then you double him. They have not figured that out. They pitch the ball all over the place when that post gets doubled, whether they're not cutting hard enough, which I think is a big point. Everyone says whether you're cutting, filling, you're diving, or whatever you're doing, if it's a big-to-big double, you're diving, you're big and filling. Like, that's got to be bad. That's got to be a sense of urgency. You can't jog through those cuts. They have to improve their post action out of post doubles. But, yeah, I think they have point guard play. They defend. They've got experience. I think Isaiah Moss is huge, huge for them and his shot-making. I think they are Final Four, National Championship good.
All right. The top five came out. All right. And we've talked about a few of them. We've talked about Duke. We've talked about Kansas. You've talked about Kansas and Oregon, Seth. All of a sudden, Oregon moves into the top five in the country. And I think they deserve it. Like, I look at Oregon and I say to myself, wait a second. You know, everybody's going to talk about Gonzaga out west because that's what they should do. They're the number one team in the country. But I watched Oregon come into Michigan, and that was a tough game, and the Pritchard kid just took the entire thing over midway through the second half, and that deal was done, Seth. Oregon out here, man, two losses in a row, back-to-back. I think it was Gonzaga, and then it was North Carolina. This is a good Oregon team, man. This is a team that, once again, is back in the consciousness of college basketball no one talks about.
Yeah, well, they're off the beaten path. Now, here's a couple things with Oregon. I think Shakur Justin's got to get healthy. I think they missed him. Watching that Gonzaga game, Justin gets some extra possessions. He's quick off his feet. He's an offensive rebounder. He plays hard. He's an upperclassman. C.J. Walker's maturity will be important. The freshman, who is a freak athlete. They got Dontayne Fowley back right now, the big 7-foot kid who I think will help them defensively. They're not great defensively. They own the tempo of the game with their defense by extending it, playing some matchup zones, playing some switching man-to-man. But you mentioned Peyton Pritchard. I think Peyton Pritchard, he'll be in the conversation with player of the year. That dude is tough. That dude, you know, I said that Anthony Cowan was the Mario Arado Rivera of college basketball. Let me tell you something, Pritchard, at the end of games, that dude is tough. Anthony Mathis, who was his high school teammate, shoots 50 from the three. The Chris Duarte, the junior college kid from Hutchinson, Kansas, he has a scorer's mentality, a physicality to him. Will Richardson is getting better. So I agree with you. I think that style of play, the ability to keep you off balance with their defense, the freedom they play with offensively, an elite point guard. You know, I think in Fowley, the kind of like, he's the X factor. How good is he? He's played, what, three games or so? I mean, we don't know how good he is. He's averaging 8 points in like 15 minutes or so. But, I mean, he's a humongous body. So, I think that they're for real. The game Oregon plays against Washington, another team that I think is one of those off the beaten path. They got two lottery picks and maybe a second-round draft pick in Naz Carter. I mean, Washington's good, but they throw the ball all over the damn place.
I text you watching them. I go, whoa. Do these guys have guys? I'm talking about Washington. All right, every night college basketball delivers. And on this particular night, the night we're doing it, January 2nd, we got a couple interesting games, Seth. And I want to not talk about the games because people listen to this at different times, but I want to talk about the teams. Illinois takes on Michigan State. Michigan State has
a big game.
Yeah, started number one. Where's Michigan State right now?
I think they're a work in progress at best. I do think that, you know, the intricacy of Cassius plays, he has that, they held him out, obviously, the other day against Western Michigan. I do think they're getting better. And I know Tom always talks about we're getting a chance to practice. They get through that one series where they're playing. You know how it is. And you're playing games all the time, and you're preparing for games, but you're not helping your team. You're just helping your team beat your opponent. I think, the big thing with Aaron Henry, which Aaron Henry is going to show up, I think that's important. I think having Rocket Watts back is really important to take a little pressure and another guy to beat you off the bounce. I think that's important. But I'll tell you, the guy that impressed me, and I know it was Western Michigan, but I literally just focused on watching him the other day, and that's Bingham. I looked at Bingham the other day, and I saw a kid that, like the light bulb, sometimes you see the light bulb go on in a kid's mind.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a kid that was alert defensively, that could block a shot, that could rebound a ball in traffic, that was a little bouncier, that could finish, score around the basket, still wasn't, maybe strong enough. And, he has weaknesses. But if they can get a consistency from Bingham to complement Xavier Tillman, and then on the wing, just get a little bit, between Gabe Brown and Aaron Henry, one of those guys needs to play well. That I think they'll be good. Now, Illinois is a hard team to play against, as you know. I mean, let me ask you a better question. No one knows that league better than you. Which Illinois team is going to show up?
No. Here's what I think about Illinois, and I had a chance to talk to Brad Underwood. I think Illinois has overthought it. I do, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Brad, they changed the rules on trapping, right? They said in your space and all that kind of stuff, and you see a trap, and then the official makes a foul, and then he makes that signal up and down, all that kind of stuff. And I think Brad gave that too much credit. I do, and we talked about that because his defense was really difficult to play. It was different in the Big Ten. They trapped you. They doubled. They made it hard on you, not just we're going to play good, tough, half-court offense. They did certain things in their man-to-man, mostly with the trap. I think he's overthought it, Seth. I do. And I think there's a little bit of that. And I also think, and this may be me speaking out of turn and people can get mad at me once again, but I look at Aya DeSumo and I say to myself, are you locked into college or are you thinking about other things? Are you?
Oh, boy.
And I'm not saying he is. I'm not saying he isn't. But it hit me. We coached long enough that certain things strike you and you don't even know why they do. And I'm like, man, I'm watching them. I'm thinking, are you really invested? Like there's a kid, I was just listening the other day. It's a kid named Jacob Eason at Washington University who just committed. He's a quarterback, committed to the NFL, just left Washington. And I think it was Brock Hewitt that said, college was always an ends to a means. It wasn't really, he was invested, this kid Easton, as a quarterback in college. And I almost feel that way this year about DeSumo. And that's got to change because he is a first round talent. So, opportunity for a big win is what Illinois has, opportunity to get right. But there's all kind of games. We mentioned Oregon. Oregon's going to play Buffalo, and Buffalo, to me, is a team that, you know, Tad Boyle has. It's tough to play against. I coach against Tad. See, I mean, they're tough. But every night, Seth. All right, let me go this route with you.
Right, let me yeah. say one thing about, yeah. about the Illinois defense. You think playing the two bigs...
Oh, it's hard in this day and age. It's hard.
And playing the two bigs and defending the way he wants to defend, I think when they throw out one of those bigs has to rotate, I think he's worried about when people throw out of some type of double or, like, can those, you know, like, will they get in foul trouble? Will they put people on the line so early because they've been thrown out in rotation that those two guys can't cover? That was just my gut feeling. I agree with you on DeSumo, just kind of like sneaker guys.
I call them shoe guys. I do.
I don't have to bring the shoe guy thing into you. And I agree with you on Buffalo, by the way. I mean, Colorado. Colorado is interesting. They turn people over, but they turn the ball over a ton. Like, and it's crazy because McKinley Wright, you would think they wouldn't turn the ball over that much. But the Bay kid is really, really good. The Batty kid is a big-bodied kid. That will be a hard game for Oregon to play. I totally agree with you.
All right, if you had to give five first-team All-Americans, it doesn't matter the position, just who is your first-team All-American group right now, this year as we head into the new year?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I can't find a player of the year.
No.
How's that work for it? I cannot find a player of the year. You know, just when you think, you know, a guy's emerging, whether it's Marcus Howard, then, you know, people figure him out. You know, Cassius Winston early. You know, Vernon Carey. Is it Peyton Pritchard? Is it? So, I mean, I think it's really, really difficult. So I would go with right now, just the way they are playing. I don't want to just throw names out to you. So I want to give some deep thought because we're not playing with it. Because here's the deal. Cause I did a list of another reason why I have no life. I actually made a list of guys in the draft the other day. And I can tell you one thing. One, there are not a lot of shot makers in the draft. There's just not a lot of dudes that can make shots. I mean, it's the craziest thing in the world. So I'm going to go through my list here. I'm going to let you tell me who you think. All right. So if I had to go All-Americans, like everyone's in love with Anthony Edwards, right? Doesn't know how to play off the ball, has no feel for the game. Just has no feel for the game. I would say that Vernon Carey would have to be an All-American by the season he's having. Like, Nico Mannion, he's a nice player. Is he an All-American? I don't know. I'd probably have to go with Devin Dotson because he's a winning player. I might have gone with Trey Jones, but, you know, he was out. I would go with Peyton Pritchard. All right? Like, Miles Powell's missed games, or he couldn't be my player of the year. I mean, you know, you go through the two guards. I mean, like, do any of these guys get you excited? These are two guards in this year's draft. Anthony Edwards, Devin Vassell, Cassius Stanley, Nas Carter, Rob Edwards, Tyrese Maxey, Isaiah Joe. Any of those two guards get you excited?
No, Seth. Edwards got me excited one half of one game.
All right. Jordan Warren, does he get you excited?
No. That's what
I'll
I'm saying.
I think is an All-American right now is Shamir Dowdy at Auburn.
All right. I'll tell you, I think he's an All-American is Kamir Baldwin at Butler.
You know, he went through that stretch where he really struggled for three or four games, right?
Who?
Kamar Baldwin. He kind of went through a stretch where he couldn't make a shot, right?
But he plays right.
Obi Toppin's an All-American. He brings it every night.
We better talk to every Coach night. Van Gundy before he hangs up. I don't want him hanging up on us. I don't
is
want
he
him
on the
his...
phone?
Yeah.
Are we getting the great Jeff Van Gundy on the phone? We got to go big. Before we get to college, we got to get to the NBA. I got to ask him a very important question.
I think he's on with us.
What's up, guys?
Van Gundy.
How are you, Jeff?
What is going on?
Not much. You know, the bad thing is, I had no idea who you guys were just talking about, other than the guy at Dayton and the guy at Butler.
That's a good thing, boss.
That's good. No one else knows who these guys are either. Don't feel bad.
All right. How are you guys doing?
Here's the question. Two questions. when are you taking over the Knicks? I mean, like, you know, I was there when Will Street came out of the tunnel. Can we just get this done and, like, slide you back in? I mean, we can gain some type of credibility. I mean, can we get this done?
Well, you know what's interesting about any rebuilding project? And, you know, it goes to the Knicks, but it could go to any NBA team. Is everybody's all in at the start of rebuilding, but they underestimate the pain that you have to go through, and they lose the stomach too often for the rebuild about halfway through. And then they think, you know, change is the answer. And if the only thing you change is the head coach, really you've made no changes at all. Mike Miller, who's the interim coach with New York, I got to work with USA Basketball a year ago, and he is a really smart, straightforward, no BS type of coach. I think he's perfect for what New York needs. But at some point, you have to commit to someone or some group. And I'm talking about a GM-coach duo, because when you go through rebuilding, the easiest thing to do is break apart. When you get the results you know you're going to get because you're not good enough yet. That's why you're rebuilding. So I think whoever they pick next, there just has to be a longer rope given for a longer rebuild.
Man, it's been a long time, Jeff. That's been a long time. I mean, are you one of those that pins it on the owner? Are you one of those that pins it on somebody else?
Well, I worked actually for the owner and Jim Dolan. And I'll have to say, when I was there, the stories that you hear now, like, it wasn't the same way. Now, I had a great leader in Dave Checkets, who ran both the Knicks and the Rangers. And so I think he absorbed some of the, you know, issues that might have cropped up between a coach and an ownership or vice versa. And so I probably don't realize it, but the one thing Mr. Dolan consistently did was he gave us the necessary resources to win. Nothing was ever turned down because we can't afford it or we can't afford that player. And secondarily, at that point, he did not at any time try to tell you who to play or who not to play. It was about winning. And I thought he was very supportive from that standpoint. Now, back in those days, you didn't have as much daily, weekly, or monthly contact with ownership as you may well have today. But I give him credit. He was a good guy as far as from an owner standpoint to work for, because he gave you resources, he wanted to win, and he gave you the opportunity to coach and coach your way. So I don't know how much it's changed in the last 20 years, but for me, he was good. Now, I will say, though, everything does start with ownership. You have to have the right ownership in place to win consistently in any sport.
How about like free? Like how can like the Knicks not be a destination? Maybe, and again, maybe you grew up in New York, and you know you grew up at a time where the Knicks were really, really special. How can? But it's still New York, just like LA is still LA. How can New York and the Knicks not be a free agency destination when they had all that money? I mean, that's a mind-boggling thing to me.
Well, I think because of how the game is now covered, in that your accomplishments are considered worthless unless you win championships, I think the players now have been influenced dramatically by the media. So think about how the media talks about people now. It's either, you know, regular season doesn't matter. It's all what you do in the playoffs. So now, like a Stockton and a Malone, their accomplishments would be downgraded in how the game is covered today. So I think players realize that, agents realize that, and they want to go to a place where they can win and win bigger. And so they look at roster construction more so than maybe people did in years gone by. And so I really believe, though, as you guys know, I don't care what level you're at. I laugh when people say the NBA is a players league. Well, guess what? Every league's a players league. I coached fourth grade girls basketball about 7 years ago. That was a players league. every league's a players league. So you have to have the right guys on your team, and you have to find the right best player, and that is the challenge for the Knicks. Can they find a star? They traded away Porzingis. They didn't believe he was that guy. Finding that guy is hard, but they've got to find someone, Patrick Ewing type, to build around for the long term. And that's what all the great teams have. They have cornerstone players that you can build around.
Hey, Jeff, you mentioned Patrick Ewing. I mean, he's coaching. I think he's doing a hell of a job, given the fact that he's kicked kids off and all kind of different things. A player's league, a player that, you know, guys know, would he be a fit there?
Well, I'll say I don't think his playing career would help him.
Right.
Because these players today, like, I'm not even sure, like, how much his players know at Georgetown how great he was.
They don't. I talked to him about that. You know, they don't.
Yeah. Like, they don't realize that, you know, they may be a pain in his ass, and he was probably a pain in John Thompson's ass some, but this guy was the real deal every single night. Like, people talk about if only a player or a team was more consistent. And I laugh at that because, like, if only a player was more consistent, he'd be a good player or a better player. And same with teams. Like, guess what? The only teams that are consistent are the really good and the really bad. And they're consistent because of their players and their players' attitudes. So I don't think Patrick's, you know, if I was the Knicks and they open up their head coaching search and they're looking at Patrick, I wouldn't hire him because he was a great Knick player. What I would consider him, though, is I think, like you mentioned, Dan, he's an outstanding coach. Like, I coached with him in Houston. Terrific ability to teach, coach, understand players, but not give in to players. I've been at practices. He's not like a new school, everybody hug it up type of guy, but he's going to get on people to pass, play hard, play to their strengths. So I think he'd be an outstanding NBA head coach. I don't think just in New York. I think he'd be an outstanding NBA head coach for any team that was serious about winning.
Well, yeah, you say, you know, the players always had control. So, I mean, like, so when you were at Yale, I mean, you figured you just weren't given enough control, so you had to just bolt?
Listen, you know how bad a player you are, Seth? You actually coached me at five-star basketball camp.
I did.
You know how bad you have to be? I go to the Ivy League, and they don't even let me try out. They cut me after fall workouts. That's how bad I was compared to, you know, the Butch Graves recruiting class that they had brought in. That was actually good. But they actually did me, Ray Carrazzo, who I'll never forget, like, he did me I thought I was getting screwed at that point, but he did me a great, great service in that he told me I wasn't good enough. And when you get told that, you have to make some hard choices. I chose to leave Yale and go JUCO because I wanted to keep playing. And then I bounced around and finished up playing. But I can't imagine what walk-ons do or 14th men do. Like, I give them so much credit because I wanted to play. So I'm glad I didn't sit around hoping to, you know, play at some point a few minutes here, a few minutes there. I was glad I got to go play Division III basketball, junior college basketball. And even though at the time I thought, man, this guy is missing out on a great talent, he was right. I wasn't good enough.
You got to be the only guy ever. I would bet ever to leave Yale because of basketball and go JUCO. Like, that's not leaving, like, Indiana. That, you know, we give out degrees on the street corner in Indiana. That's Yale you're leaving to go play JUCO basketball. You got to be the only guy ever.
Yeah, I might be, and I don't know if my mom has yet to forgive me for that one.
Right.
But, right. So, you know what I found about Yale, though, guys? This was very interesting. I had to have the lowest SAT scores of the freshman class, right? So I had I think it was a 1060, okay? And so I knew going in, I didn't really know what I was in for, but, you know, you start going to class and you realize, okay, if you go to class and you study, you know, a little bit. Like, I was like 2 hours a night. I wasn't ever going to get an A, and I wasn't ever going to get a D. I was going to be the BC student. So when guys fail out, of like, in, like, if you go to class and you study a moderate amount, you're going to get benefit of the doubt. I mean, I got benefits of the doubt because I was there every day. But, yeah, I think I'm – I know I'm the last guy to ever go from Yale to Menlo Junior College in in Menlo. I played for a great coach, though, Bud Presley, who I grew up Bud going Presley, to his camps great. And everything. So, like, because they've changed now to a four-year school. So I know I'm the last guy to ever leave Yale for playing time and go JUCO to Menlo.
But yeah. But it's playing time at Yale that didn't exist. Because you weren't on the team, right?
No, you know what was interesting? So back then at Yale, they had the varsity, and then they had a freshman team. And the freshman team was, like, for the varsity rejects. And they played a very, like, you know, like a maybe a 10-game schedule. So I didn't want to – I knew I was going to leave to go play someplace else, so I didn't want to play on the freshman team, lose a year of eligibility. Because at that time, the NCAA rules were such that you couldn't go from even not playing at Division I to Division III and play immediately. You had to sit out. So I had to go JUCO if I was going to do it that way. But the interesting part was they had 15 guys on the varsity, and at the very start of practice, they lost, like, you know, two or three guys to injury. So now they needed someone to practice. So I actually practiced the whole year with them. But I knew they had no plans for me. They were good to me, but they had no plans for me. So I practiced all year with the varsity, and it was great. I thought I learned a lot. But I was JUCO bound right after that.
All right, I say David Stern. You say what?
You know, I didn't know him that well personally. I knew him well enough to know that he didn't like me a whole lot because he, you know, he ruled the NBA with an iron fist. And when I was under that iron fist, like, you know, I resented it at times because, you know, he was not for free speech. But what I, you know, the two things I take away from my time when I was in the NBA and he was the commissioner was he made a lot of people a lot of money. He had, his business decisions, like I said, made people a lot of money. And the second thing is, after you step back and you see how the league is trending now, you understand why he did rule with an iron fist. And so I think I understand better right now why, you know, he did not employ democratic principles when running his business, because oftentimes every time you try to be nice, it's perceived as weakness and people take advantage of it. And so he ruled it with an iron fist. I got smacked with that iron fist quite often. And yet now as I take a step back or as he left, and I see, you know, how the league is trending, I understand why he did what he did.
What do you mean by how the league is trending? Is it a positive or a negative?
Well, I think it's all your perception. And I think there are some positives. I think there's also some negatives. I think from a media standpoint, I'll just give you one. It used to be where he knew the media was such an important factor in the growth of the league that he demanded it. And, like, you didn't leave. You got fined if you didn't do interviews after games. And you got fined if you weren't cooperative with the national broadcast partners when I'll give an example. Like, if I was coaching the Knicks and we flew to Miami, right? When you got off the bus at the hotel in Miami, the national broadcasting team was already set up in a ballroom and they would get the top three players that they wanted to talk to. They would knock it out and then the coach would come in. And it wasn't up for debate. It was, this is your responsibility. Now, whenever we go to games, we'll never get a starter. We might get a bench player. Or the rare, like, team like Golden State, they're very good. They'll give you, you know, they'll give you access, right? Now, for me, I don't mind it because I don't care about hearing from the players. But Mike Green and the play-by-play guys, it's vital to their job. We pay, I don't know, over $1 billion, and there's absolutely no access. And I think the players would say, that's great. They should have the right to do that. Me, I see it as going to eventually cost everyone a lot of money because if I'm, you know, ESPN, TNT, or whoever else may bid on these properties, if I'm not going to get cooperation, I'm not paying as much. And so, again, some people may say, well, that's the player's right. They should be able to do it. And I understand that point of view. From my standpoint, I say it's going to cost everybody eventually some money because there's not the cooperation that there once would be. And David Stern, you know, he just did it differently. He was going to come and he would, you know, threaten you, your organization, your team, you know. So, that's how he would do it different.
How about you got to give us one now. Is it really true that Riley would script his pregame talks? What was the best pregame talk you ever heard?
He would, like, and frankly, it's like the one, when it comes to that point, he would absolutely write out practice. But what I took from it was every word that you say to your team is important and can be really good, or if you fly off the cuff, it can be really negative. And so, the best one we ever had, we were playing in the 93 Eastern Conference Finals before game one. Now, I don't know about in college, but in the NBA, you sit in the same spot, both coaches and players, like pregame, on the bus, on the airplane, you get off in the same order every time, right? So I always sat in pregame between Charles Oakley was on my left, Anthony Mason was on my right, okay? So one thing you know is when Pat used to sometimes get really deep with his stories, and the deeper they got, the more that the player's head started to tilt a little bit. So Pat, now we're going out to play Michael Jordan, right? So Pat says, have you guys ever heard about the scorpion and the frog, right? So right away, there was some head tilting, okay? And so he goes through this story where he said, scorpions can't swim. The frog is in the little lake. The scorpion asked the frog for a ride from one side of the lake to the other. And so the scorpion says, hey, frog, can you give me a ride over there? And the frog said, no, because you'll sting me and I'll drown and I'll die. And the scorpion said, I'm not going to sting you because if you die and I sting you, I can't swim. I'm going to drown with you. So they go back and forth negotiating this. Give me a ride. No, I'm not going to give it to you. Finally, the frog relents. The scorpion hops on his back. They're halfway across the lake. And lo and behold, the scorpion stings the frog. Now, the frog is going down. The scorpion's going down. And they're both know now they're going to drown and die. And so the frog asks the scorpion, why did you sting me? And the scorpion said, because that's what I do. I sting frogs. And that's where Pat leaves it. Now, I'm telling you, Oakley's head's on my shoulder, my left shoulder, and Mason's head is on my right shoulder. It's tilted so much. Like, all they're thinking about is, you know, I got to guard Michael Jordan in 10 minutes, right? So Riley says to Dick Carter, who was our top assistant, who would have been a great coach in any sport, he says, Dick, you got anything to add? So Dick was like in his 70s. He wanders out there. He looks around. He goes, yeah, Pat, I got one thing to add. When that effing BJ Armstrong starts fiddling with his mouth guard, I want someone to walk over there, rip it out of his effing mouth, and stick it up his effing ass. And Oakley and Mason like sprung up like, yeah, that's what. Yeah. So they came in together and Riley goes, because that's what we do. We sting bulls. right? And there was so much physical violence in that locker room pregame. It was like a football where they used to bang pads and bang helmets. I was like, I don't know if we're going to win, but there's going to be some people lying on the ground in this game. And it was one of the most physical games we have ever been a part of. We had home. That was a series. We went up 2-0 and we lost. Then they won four straight. And it was the Charles Smith missed layup game. That's how close we felt we were to a championship. I mean, we had a great team. They had a great team. But, man, Riley, on that night, that was one of his best.
Let me ask you, the two guys you mentioned are tough, tough guys, all right? Could you have, in that scenario, bypassed the whole Scorpion speech and just gone with what Dick Harter said, gotten the same reaction?
Well, I'll tell you, Riley, my first year with him, we're out in, it's a long-winded response, but the answer is yes sometimes. You know, Pat has one of these stories before every game. So, and they go on like, you know, 10, 12 minutes, right? So, we're out on the West Coast and we're going to play the Clippers in a back-to-back situation. And Pat's got laryngitis from the game before. So he can't do the pregame talk. And he says, Dick, you got to do the pregame talk. But, you know, Dick is a different type of coach. He's not going to necessarily go for as long. So, Pat, all day in our meetings with Dick, what are you going to say? He goes, Pat, I got it. And Pat wants to know what's the story, what's the message. And Dick would not reveal it. He goes, Pat, I got it. So, you know, on one side of the board is my side. It's the X and O's. Pat would have some his side of the board. When he was doing a speech, he might write some stuff down. So, Dick goes up there about a minute before I'm going to talk, and he writes he has a little circle, then he has a little heart under the little circle, and then he has two little circles under the heart. So I do my thing for a couple minutes, and Pat says, I can't speak. Dick's going to give the talk. So the players are braced for this, you know, long, you know, story, right? Dick goes up there and he looks at the board. He looks at the players. He looks at the board. He looks at the players. And then he turns and he starts hitting the board. And he goes, head, heart, balls. That's how you win in this league. That was it. It's awesome. Oh, and you know what, man, I loved about it is it shows you if you're yourself, right?
Right.
You do it your way. You don't try. You learn from everybody, but you don't try to personally try to be anybody else. And so, like, you know, Pat would have a great story. Dick would have a very short emotional message. And they were both great, great coaches.
Hey, Jeff, speaking of that era, and you're talking about guys being left, you know, knocking down guys, grabbing a guy's mouthpiece. What is your take on the way the game is played today in the NBA?
Well, I think, you know, just like in the NFL, every advantage has been given to the offensive players, right? So comparing numbers from one era to another era is really hard because everybody's playing, you know, with different rules. So I would like to see a little bit more balance between, I think generally what David Stern and Jerry Colangelo set up a long time ago, which was to take out the overly physical play that hinders offense, I think was brilliant for the NBA. Absolutely brilliant. And I think it's swung so far now that we've got to give some leeway back to the defense one. One of the things that bothers me, and I don't see it in college basketball as much as the NBA, these guys who throw themselves into people to draw fouls, like on jump shots, mm-hmm. like to me, it used to be the way the game was officiated. If you tried that in the NBA official would just look at you like, you're not getting away with that. You're going to take a legitimate shot to score. And if you do get fouled, I'll call it, but you're not going to just dive into somebody's body and me reward you. And so stuff like that, I'd like to see out of the game. because I'd like to see more balance between, you know, offense and defense. And I, obviously the league is always going to tilt to giving more leeway to the offensive teams. But I just think that there should be a little bit more physicality. I think fans, players, they like a little bit more physicality. Never to go back to the 90s. No, that was, you know, that was too physical. But a little bit more physicality, I think, would be of great benefit to both our players and to our fans.
You talk about physicality. Everyone's talking about, you know, the length of the season and basically resting players, guys taking days off. The teams that you had, would they benefited from that? Or is like the mentality was just, man, we're just playing ball. I mean, like the amount of money that is being paid, you know, I know, Dan, you believe in this. Like, you know, doctors don't take days off. Teachers don't take days off. Civil servants don't take days off. Yet multi-billion-dollar entities of players that are flying in private planes, having their own massage therapists and catered meals and everything else, are demanding or need days off. How do you approach that? I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think the first thing is everybody talks sports science. But there's nothing scientifically that has ever been presented that this is actually better for the players or the teams. Like most things, you're trying to, as head coaches, we all tried to pace our team correctly. I mean, Bill Parcells spoke about that back in the 1980s, that one of the number one jobs of any head coach is to pace his team correctly. So, you know, our teams, we gave a lot of days off. We had very few contact practices, if ever. Like if you had a game, a day off, and then a game, we never had contact in the day in between. So I think there was a lot of involvement back then. I think a lot more was given to the coaches to use their eyes, their ears, and their common sense on how to pace the team. The one thing I think, again, it's going to end up costing us money. For the people that play it, coach it, and own it, because it's really bait and switch in that you advertise our star players, come see our stars. They're unlike any other athletes in the world, and I agree with that. And then that player sits out, not because of health reasons, but because they don't want him to get injured. And so I think, you know, some owners, some teams, they actually believe it's good. I actually think it's going to cost us all. And I think one of the things that people don't understand is you were in shape. Conditioning was such a big factor back then that you could go big minutes and play every night. And that's part of the greatness of like a Michael Jordan. Like he was great basically every night and he had to do it 4 games in 5 nights. And he knew people were coming to see him. Like, they weren't coming to see Luke Longley and Will Perdue or the Bulls. They were coming to see Michael Jordan. And he felt that obligation to play every night. And this is where I was saying before about just how it's different. And some people would have a perspective, well, that's good. But just like in the media example I gave you, I think this is ultimately a negative for the NBA, because I think it's going to cost everybody. Because I think when you treat your fans with such disregard, eventually it will come back to hurt you. And I think it's one of the reasons for the really low ratings. I know there are many factors that go into it, but I do believe it's a factor in our low TV ratings is that our fans don't know who's going to play on a given night. And ultimately, no fan or consumer wants to be disrespected.
That's a great point. All right, last thing. We really appreciate your time. Give me your one impression of college basketball today.
You know, for all the trainers out there in the world that work with these players individually, I can't believe how unskilled they are. So I would ask the trainers, like, what are you doing with these players? Like, you know, they all have them dribbling 4 balls and, you know, but they can't move without the ball. They can't come off a screen and shoot. I think the shooting is like, and the passing is like not up to standard. I think it's got to get a lot better. And that's why when you see a team that can play, that can have multiple guys that can pass and shoot and make plays off the dribble, it just jumps out on you. The thing the defense in college basketball to me is so far ahead of the offense, because I think most teams, most coaches, they do a fabulous job in getting their teams to play incredibly hard, defensively and on the board. But to me, I don't know, I don't watch as much as you guys do. The difference between teams is offensive skill. Who can score? Who can, you know, who can count on people to put the ball in the basket, and who runs stuff that is actually hard to guard? You know, some of these teams I watch in college that they play, everybody says we want to play like the Golden State Warriors, but they play with a point guard who can't shoot or pass, and they run a lot of pick and rolls for him. I'm like astounded. Like, why are you putting a guy in a pick and roll that can't shoot or pass? I don't know. That's what I see.
Oh, I think you're so right. I think you're so
right. So right on
right.
The money right there.
Thanks, right, Coach.
The we talk about it all the time, right? Right, Dad?
Yeah, I mean, it amazes me. And we were just talking before you came on. Like, if I live in Indy, I cover the Colts, I cover the Pacers. If the Pacers got who, would you be excited here for their team? And I can't come up with anybody. And that's more or less to your point. I mean, I don't, you know, you're not getting a Patrick Ewing. Anyway, Coach, we've kept you a long time, man. I appreciate, we could have gone on all day, and I can't thank you enough for a few minutes.
All right. You guys have a great time. Appreciate your knowledge of basketball. And I love how you guys cover college basketball. It's not just pom-poms all the time. It's actual truth. So
thanks, brother. Thank you.
All right. Take care, man.
All right.
Thank you.
That's Jeff Van Gundy.
How good was that? That was the best we ever had.
I think so.
Why, you know why? That's why we're the world's greatest podcast.
I think so, too. I do. I think that. Let's end it with a little bit of this. You're a Knicks guy, all right? I mean, you grew up going to the Garden.
I grew up with him.
As a Knicks fan, would you like to see Patrick Ewing there?
I would like, if I had my choices, here are the three people, one of these three people I would hire. Without, not even close. And then you don't even hear, I would either hire Patrick Ewing, Van Gundy, or Pitino. Boom. End of story. There's three people I would interview. There's three people I would hire. And then I would tell them, all right, if it was Pitino, keep him out of personnel. The Knicks, and he made a great point there. Like, there's got to be you can't have a good locker room until you have a core group. Like, think about the last time the Knicks had a core group in the locker room that could coach their locker room, that could set a standard. They've got to figure out a way to get a core group and then build around that core. But those, one of those three guys that are one of three people that I would hire.
No, that makes sense. All right, let me ask you this. You put out a team of the decade. Do you have it with you?
Yeah.
What you got?
No, but I think I can. Here's the deal. I mean, team of the decade. All right. So Zion Williams has got to be on it. I understand he was hurt, but he redefined what he did in college basketball is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he was just a freak. All right. Anthony Davis impacted the game in ways not just by scoring, but by running, jumping, blocking shots, winning championships. Kemba Walker was the best closer in college basketball. Dougie McBuckets, to me, you know, he stood the test of time. You know, I mean, like what he was able to do, how he was able to do that, you know, to me was phenomenal. And Jalen Brunson, yeah, exactly. And Jalen Brunson. I just thought Jalen Brunson, two national championships, his poise. Like McDermott and Brunson, what they were able to do over a period of time, the manner in which they played, were just phenomenal. To do what Dougie McBuckets did at Creighton, to do what Brunson did at Villanova, that's to me a pretty good all-decade team.
You know, if I was going to pick a player of the decade, I think I might pick Brunson. Two national titles, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, some people say Shabazz Napier had two national titles, but he's not in the same category.
No, he's not. And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, I can't believe you're forgetting Zion Williamson. Well, yeah, okay.
I had Zion on there, but he would have been the best. You could have Kevin Durant. I mean,
you could have Trey Burke on there.
I passed on him.
Trey Burke, you can make the argument. Sure. Trey Burke
was one of the guys I looked at, yeah. Here is the deal. It goes back to the same thing. It's all the prism you look at it through. But we're going to have guys from this season that 10 years from now, we're going to go, damn, that guy was really good. And we don't know who it'll be, but someone's going to emerge. It could be Vernon Carey. It could be someone else. Now, like the All-American thing, it's hard to find an All-American team that you're excited about. But I'll tell you what, league play, level playing field. The games are going to be amazing. Cherish wins. How do you handle adversity? Can you get to the next play? You better be up to score in a short clock. You better be able to get the ball in bounds on a dead ball in bounds at the end of games. Because one thing about league play, no secrets. Because coaches don't change their spots. They are who they are. And scouting in league play is at a different level. And we are going to see incredible games the next 3 months.
Yes, we are, my friend. One resolution.
Oh, you know what? The last thing we got to get on the podcast. We forgot to get until everything's solidified. We know that about it. Burgers, bourbon, brackets, Greenberg and Dockage could be coming to a town close to you. If you're smart, hit us up.
I think we're already establishing ourselves. It'll be finalized hopefully this week. We're going to be in New York City the week of the NCAA tournament,
and maybe take one in Atlanta too. You know, for the Final Four, it could be beef, bourbon, brackets, Greenberg Dockage, Final Four championships. We will entertain you.
Hit me up with an email if you'd like, dan@1070thefan.com. If you'd like to host Seth Greenberg and Dan Dockage, and we will. Here's the deal: we're going to make you money because we're going to tell you how to bet the NCAA tournament. We're going to tell you who's going to win, and your brackets will not be busted. And if they are, you'll still cover the spread because we'll give you that kind of information. How about that?
B squared, more organized than crime.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We will talk to you next week. This is the world's greatest podcast, Courtside, Greenberg and Dockage.
Thank you for listening to Courtside with Greenberg and Dockage. You can listen and subscribe to all ESPN podcasts in the Listen tab of the ESPN app, including the latest from the NBA and the Hoop Collective podcast, available in the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts.